and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the alarming statement that Donald Trump is said to have made to a foreign policy expert who was briefing him, during which, on three occasions, Trump asked, "If we have nuclear weapons, why can't we use them?" Joseph Cirincione, the president of the Plowshares Fund and the author of Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons, joins us to discuss the dangerous ignorance displayed by Donald Trump in blithely rejecting the fundamental role of nuclear weapons as a deterrent, which is largely why no nuclear weapon has been used since Nagasaki. We will assess the possibility of a civil military breakdown if Trump were to be president, resulting in a possible mutiny, not to mention foreign powers interpreting Trump's statements as a radical new nuclear policy that could shatter the shaky peace in a world where there are 16,000 nuclear weapons in the hands of the US, Russia, China, India, France, the UK, Israel, North Korea, and Pakistan. Then, with the front page of Wednesday's New York Times displaying a photo of a Filipino woman cradling her dead husband in her arms beside a handwritten note left by vigilantes branding the dead rickshaw driver a drug dealer, we will examine the death toll of 704 killed since the new president of the Philippines encouraged extrajudicial killings. Hannah Hetzer, a senior policy manager of the Americas at the Drug Policy Alliance, joins us to discuss her article at the Huffington Post, "Why is the U.S. silent on massacres of drug users in the Philippines?" and the deafening silence from the U.S. as 300 human rights organizations around the world call on the U.N. to denounce the violence. Then finally, we'll examine the record-breaking commutations of 214 federal prisoners by President Obama today, the largest single-day grant of commutations in American history. Donna Hamm, a retired judge who's the founder and executive director of Middle Ground Prison Reform, joins us to discuss the release of mostly low-level drug offenders. And while Obama is to be commended for pardoning and commuting the sentences of 562 prisoners so far, it will take the Congress to change the draconian laws that fill up federal, state, and private prisons with those convicted of minor offenses. And joining us now is Joseph Cirincione, who's the president of the Plowshares Fund and author of Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons. He previously directed nonproliferation and international policy programs at the Center for American Progress and the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He also worked on the professional staffs of the House Committee on Armed Services and the Committee on Government Operations and served as a staff director of the Bipartisan Military Reform Caucus. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joseph Cirincione.
Thank you, Ian. Nice to be back.
And good to have you back, Joe, and the other Joe, Morning Joe, the co-host, Joe Scarborough. On Wednesday, in an interview with former NSA and CIA Director Michael Hayden, said, quoting, "Several months ago, a foreign policy expert on the international level went to advise Donald Trump, and three times he asked about the use of nuclear weapons. Three times he asked, at one point, if we have them, why can't we use them?" Now, this is, I think, sends shockwaves through the defense and intelligence community. And I guess it shows a fundamental ignorance on Trump's part about what nuclear deterrence is and why there hasn't been a nuclear weapon used since Nagasaki, the anniversary of which is, what, about a week away. He obviously has no idea how important it is at a statecraft level talking about nuclear weapons, because your statements on nuclear weapons could be construed as policy.
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely right. I was watching the show when that happened, and the panelists just froze. They were stunned by this, and then the social media just exploded all morning over this. And this was a busy news day. There was a lot of other things going on, but this subject really touched a nerve. And it's this issue of our nuclear system, our system of command and control of the nuclear weapons that we have, is based on the premise that there is a sane, rational individual at the top of the command chain. And there are serious questions about the fitness of Donald Trump to hold the office of the presidency on lots of levels, but it's this level that gives people the greatest pause. You might make an unwise choice on a health care policy or a Supreme Court nominee or mess up the relations with a foreign country, but on the nuclear side, you could end the world. People don't appreciate that there are no checks and balances on the president's authority to use nuclear weapons. There's no cabinet meeting, there's no vote, there's no Supreme Court judge. The president and the president alone has the authority to use nuclear weapons, and he can use them almost instantly. It's a matter of minutes from a decision to use nuclear weapons to a transmission of the order to the verification of that order's authenticity, not its correctness, not whether this is the right thing to do, just did the president say this, and once it's determined that he did, then the chain of command goes and proceeds to launch nuclear weapons. Maybe it's one, maybe it's 1,000 nuclear weapons. It's all automatic. That is what sent shockwaves around the national security and intelligence communities today.
But prior to this, Donald Trump had even suggested the use of nuclear weapons in Europe. He had suggested that maybe the Japanese and South Koreans should go nuclear. I mean, he said some pretty crazy things.
Yes.
But this is in a whole new ball game, right? I mean, this is
Right. He suggested that maybe it's a good idea for Saudi Arabia to have nuclear weapons, or it's a good idea for Japan to have nuclear weapons, or that the spread of nuclear weapons is inevitable. Well, this is those policies, if implemented, would reverse 71 years of bipartisan U.S. national security strategy. We have never said it was okay for another country to have nuclear weapons, and certainly not our adversaries, but not our friends. We didn't agree that Britain should get them, or France, or Israel. We've been opposed to the spread of these weapons, and here you have a candidate for president saying maybe it's a good thing. He also doesn't appear to know what the nuclear triad is. When asked in an early debate, he couldn't answer it. And this question today, this issue about why don't we use them, he doesn't appear to understand why we don't use them, and the answers are threefold. One, we don't need to use them. We are the most powerful conventional military force on the planet. We have plenty of conventional military options. We've been in wars for the last 70 years. We've lost wars over the last 70 years. A president has never decided to use a nuclear weapon. Number two, if we did, it would have horrifying consequences. One nuclear weapon, even a small so-called tactical nuclear weapon, is still many times the size of the bomb that destroyed Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It would be a level of destruction unseen since World War II. And the third reason is what happens next. Once you cross that line, once you break the nuclear taboo, the taboo against use, what do other countries do? What do terrorists do? What's the reaction of the world to our use of this weapon? None of that appears to have been thought out by Mr. Trump.
And again, I'm speaking with Joseph Cirincione, who's the president of the Plowshares Fund and author of Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons. He previously directed nonproliferation and international policy programs at the Center for American Progress and the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And he's also worked on the professional staffs of the House Committee on Armed Services and the Committee on Government Operations and served as staff director of the Bipartisan Military Reform Caucus. The Republican Party itself is clearly having some serious problems with their candidate for president. But you can't help noticing, surely, Joseph Cirincione, the difference between what Trump has been saying and what Ronald Reagan once said, a nuclear war cannot be won and must never be fought. And given what an icon President Reagan is to Republicans, you'd think that would be etched in stone.
Yeah, you know, President Reagan in his second inaugural address, you know, said that it was his dream, his hope that we could one day eliminate nuclear weapons from the face of the earth. When John McCain was contending with Barack Obama for the nomination, for the election 8 years ago, you know, he had a very similar position on nuclear weapons as Barack Obama did. He said we should reduce them to the lowest number possible, reduce their role in U.S. national security strategy and try and work for their elimination. You don't hear that today from the Republican Party. You certainly don't hear it from the candidate. That's why it's all the more important over the next few weeks that President Obama use the authority while he still has it to reduce their role. We understand that the president is considering making some changes to nuclear policy. He's expected to announce these changes in the next few weeks. One of the things he should do is take our nuclear weapons off of alert. Right now, they are ready to fire within minutes. We don't need that. There's no reason for that. The Cold War has been over for 25 years. We don't need to have this instant ability to use nuclear weapons. We have a safe, secure, deterrent force in huge numbers. The president could lengthen the nuclear fuse. So on the not just because he would want to avoid the consequences of what would happen if Donald Trump be elected, but to reduce the risk of any president making a mistake, making a miscalculation, as we've come very close to doing in the past. The President Obama has the ability to make this a safer world over the next couple of weeks if he's got the willingness to do so, the political will to do so. I think actually this dust up over Mr. Trump's comments gives the president a political opening that he needs to make some sweeping change in U.S. nuclear policy before it's too late.
Well, Joseph Cirincione, I recall when Jimmy Carter was first briefed on the nuclear arsenal, he was absolutely shaken to the core at what mm-hmm. responsibility he had, that the officer with this briefcase chained to his wrist that follows the president around all the time, just the awesome responsibility and power that the president has. And this led Jimmy Carter in his inauguration to talk about the elimination of nuclear weapons. He was just simply shut. And of course, you know, he's a former nuclear engineer who worked under Admiral Rickover. So he's no babe in the woods when it comes to these complicated matters. But it's the blithe, casual nature of what Trump says that terrifies me. And I take it it shook up General Hayden as well.
Yes, he did. As General Hayden said this morning, we have a nuclear system that is built for rapid reaction, massive retaliation. It's not designed for debate or discussion. And so if you have an individual in control there who is impetuous, who is easy to anger, is perhaps uninformed, who doesn't think things through, then you have an extremely dangerous situation. This is one of the reasons you saw some arch conservatives today coming out with concern about those remarks. A very conservative staffer on Capitol Hill, John Noonan, went on what they call a tweet storm. He did 16 tweets explaining why he, a former nuclear officer and a strong supporter of a large nuclear arsenal, was so concerned about the comments he heard. It is now playing a big role in people's decision on what they want in a commander-in-chief. And this issue of having your finger on the nuclear button is not going to go away. I'm not sure there's anything Donald Trump could do at this point to change that. And, of course, it raises the larger question, should anyone have their finger on the nuclear button? Do we need a button that's ready to go in a few minutes, or wouldn't we benefit from changing the system so we have hours or days to debate nuclear use, not a nuclear monarch who has the ability to make the decision for the whole world?
But in terms of the briefings, which have become an issue, and nobody's quite sure of what briefings Trump has been getting or whether he's been getting them or not, there have been suggestions that he shouldn't get them, that he's not capable of keeping secrets. But it sounds like he's also desperately needs briefings, but to the point where it doesn't sound like, it's almost like the vessel is so empty that you couldn't really fill it up.
Well, there's the briefings that Joe Scarborough was talking about this morning are private briefings with his own national security staff. He is about to get, I believe it's even tomorrow or certainly this week, the first national intelligence briefing that each candidate gets. So Hillary Clinton will start getting them and Donald Trump, and there really is no way to not give a candidate those kinds of briefings. There is a concern about Donald Trump's ability to concentrate or think. That Washington Post today posted the transcript of a 50-minute interview they did with him, largely on foreign policy and national security policy, and it's frightening. It's very hard to follow what he's saying. And five times he interrupts the interview to watch himself on TV and comment on what he's seeing on TV. It doesn't inspire confidence.
Well, already the head of Republicans overseas, a prominent Republican woman, has questioned
Meg Whitman, yeah.
No, she's the big donor. This is I can't remember this woman's name, but she's the head of Republicans overseas, and she has questioned his mental health.
You know, this is a subject that is increasingly coming up, and people, this is beyond certainly my expertise, but talking about the narcissistic personality disorder, a very real disorder that exists, where it's not just a question of a person thinking a great deal of themselves, but it is an uncontrollable set of behavioral patterns, a fixation on yourself, an obsession, and the inability to have empathy, for example, with others. This, I'm telling you, in Washington, increasingly there is this kind of talk about the candidate. I have never heard anything like this before, and going all the way back, there's always been policy disagreements between candidates, but never this, especially this sort of early in the campaign, and an unprovoked. This is not the other side running ads about the candidate. This is not an attack on the candidate. This is what the candidate himself is doing that is causing these profound concerns. We may be witnessing the beginning of a breakup of the Republican Party over this, a possibility where a number of Republicans will break from their presidential candidate and try to run on the congressional level, and you could see a Trump faction continue to run on the presidential level. Again, something we haven't seen in over 100 years. You have to go back to Theodore Roosevelt and Robert Taft to see this kind of split in a major party.
Well, just in closing, Joseph Cerincione, I mean, I think it's increasingly unlikely that Donald Trump would get elected, because every day there's a new disaster, and there's almost a suggestion, which I've been dealing with for months now, talking to a specialist, that he may well pull out, you know. But assuming, let's just take the scenario that he gets elected, wouldn't there be a possibility of a civil military breakdown, or something along the lines of a mutiny?
We are getting a little ahead of ourselves, but in the nuclear chain of command, there is the way this works, and is that the president would give the order, the Secretary of Defense or the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs would verify the order that this was actually coming from the president, and do that by either in person or the verifying the codes that they both carry, and then the rest of the chain of command, the commanders of the strategic force, the missile commanders, et cetera, the Air Force officers in the silos, all of them follow it. And if they had doubts about the wisdom of that, they're legally required to still do it. There's no vote, there's no debate on it. And the only way you could overturn that is if there was, in fact, a mutiny. If it was at the command level, a commander said, no, I am not going to carry out that order. There has been discussion about something like this, and you've heard some commanders say that if they were ordered to torture prisoners again, they would not do that. They would not follow that order. But that, again, unprecedented in American history. We've never been in that situation. But this campaign, this candidate does raise those issues.
And the fact that he has support in this country raises issues about America itself. I hate to say it.
Yes. And the one, you know, sort of good news for the Trump campaign this year is that he's reporting that he raised quite a lot of money, a record amount, looks like $74 million in the last month, mainly from small donors. So that raises the prospect that he has the money to continue this campaign, even while there's sort of instability and growing concern about the candidate himself, the money is starting to flow into this effort, and we could be in for a very long summer.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Joseph Cerincione.
Thank you, Ian. Pleasure to be on.
And again, I've been speaking with Joseph Cirincione, who's the president of the Plowshares Fund and author of Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons. He previously directed Nonproliferation International Policy Programs at the Center for American Progress and the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and has worked on the professional staffs of the House Committee on Armed Services and the Committee on Government Operations, and served as a staff director of the Bipartisan Military Reform Caucus. We can take a brief station break and back looking into why the U.S. is silent as drug users are massacred in the Philippines.
But the atoms here, in spite of hysteria, it flourishes in Utah as well as Siberia. And whether you're a black, white, red, or brown, the question is this when you boil it down. To be or not to be, that's the question. The answer to it all ain't military datum, like who gets there firstest with the mostest atoms. No, the people of the world must decide their fate. They got to get together or disintegrate. I hold this truth to be self-evident, that all men may be cremated equal.
I see my light come shining from the west down to the east. Any day now, I shall be released.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Hannah Hetzer, who is a senior policy manager of the Americas at the Drug Policy Alliance, based in New York, where she serves as their liaison for Latin America and broader international issues. She spent 2013 in Uruguay working on a campaign that made it the first country in the world to legalize marijuana. And she has an article at the Huffington Post, Why is the U.S. Silent on Massacre of Drug Users in the Philippines? Welcome to Background Briefing, Hannah Hetzer.
Thank you.
And the front page of Wednesday's New York Times print edition is a very harrowing picture of a Filipino woman cradling her dead husband in her arms. Apparently this picture has outraged the new president of the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte, who has called essentially for an open season on drug dealers, drug users, or anybody that might be suspected of either. And so far, this has been a slaughter, has it not been?
It really has. And, you know, we have not seen anything like this in recent memory. It is a complete violation of human rights. The president's call for citizens to take the law into their own hands and essentially murder people without trial, without due process, on the street for being suspected to either use or sell drugs is really a horrific tragedy. And since he assumed presidency and made this call in the name of anti-crime and drug control, people have made good on his plea, and over 700 people have been executed by individuals, by vigilantes, and by the police. And meanwhile, a further 115,000 people have turn themselves into authorities if they have a past drug use in this atmosphere of complete fear for their lives, but also not knowing what meets them on the other side of turning themselves in. You know, there's can be horrific prison situations and overcrowding and forced and degrading treatment, but that alternative seems the better in the situation where you're fearing for your life. And you know, it's really an unprecedented thing in recent history where we've seen a leader actually come up and use his platform to encourage his own citizens to kill their neighbors if suspected of involvement in drugs.
But apparently this atmosphere that the new president of the Philippines has created, this vigilante kind of murderous atmosphere, has caused 114,000 people to turn themselves in and be put into these overcrowded jails?
Yes, that's right. I mean, I think so. If you're faced with the you know, the option, if you might have used drugs in the past and you know there are others that know you to have done so or and fear for your life, and you're faced with the choice of staying you know, in your home and fearing murder or turning yourself into the authorities, I think a lot of people would take that choice. But as I said, they don't know what awaits them on the other side. And what we have seen, in a lot of places in Asia where treatment or what is offered under the guise of treatment is actually can often be torture or cruel and degrading treatment instead of adequate, compassionate, and voluntary treatment. So the people turning themselves in, that's also very concerning what lies them on the other side.
Well, last week in Indonesia, they resumed the executions of people convicted of drug offences, and I believe four people were shot by a firing squad.
Yes, and the case that got with the Bali Nine a lot of media attention last year with the 8 executions, and then there was a halt on executions for a while, and we're really, really discouraged to see that Indonesia has resumed these executions despite United Nations and other world leaders saying that this will potentially break diplomatic ties with them, because some of the those being executed are foreign nationals, and the United Nations saying that drug control does not include the death penalty. The death penalty is only reserved for the most serious crimes, and the UN Secretary General himself has said that does not include drug-related crimes. So it is extremely concerning to see Indonesia continue with these executions.
And again, I'm speaking with Hannah Hetzer, who's a senior policy manager of the Americas at the Drug Policy Alliance, based in New York, where she serves as a liaison for Latin America and broader international issues. She spent 2013 in Uruguay working on the campaign that made it the first country in the world to legalize marijuana. And she has an article at the Huffington Post, "Why is the U.S. silent on massacre of drug users in the Philippines?" So let's zero in on the title of your article at the Huffington Post, Hannah. Why is the U.S. silent on the massacre of drug users in the Philippines?
Well, this is something that we are urging the United States to strongly and vocally condemn. We find the silence from international authorities very concerning. It took the United Nations actually up until today to release statements, and that was when they eventually bowed to pressure from 300 organizations from around the world calling on them to do so. And the United States has not publicly condemned these killings, and it's even worse considering that U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry traveled to the Philippines last week and met with President Duterte and talked about security issues, and actually vowed to commit $32 million U.S. dollars to support Filipino law enforcement training and efforts. And that is something that we are pushing back on. We want Secretary of State Kerry and the entire administration to condemn these unlawful killings. And also, if any assistance is provided to the Philippines, it has to be in line with what's called the Leahy vetting process, which requires that any U.S. funding for foreign security must be only applied if those recipients have found not to have committed human rights abuses, and what is being committed right now in the Philippines are grave human rights abuses. So we think that funding needs to be withheld until the president calls off his lethal anti-drug campaign.
Well, the very dramatic picture that I mentioned that's on the front page of Wednesday's New York Times print edition of the Filipina woman cradling her dead husband's in her arms. He, the victim, is a rickshaw driver, and next to the body, written on a piece of cardboard with the words, "drug pusher." The widow says that he has used drugs, but he's certainly not a drug pusher, and she doesn't expect any justice. And she said, most of all, she was appalled the fact that the body was just left there lying there, on the pavement, and that's how she discovered it. So in general, it's just the coarsening of a society in this way is what's so alarming, the idea that the head of state could give permission to people to go out and kill their fellow citizens extrajudicially based on nothing more than rumors.
Absolutely. And, you know, just, of course, you know, just to make clear that no matter whether people are actually using drugs or selling drugs, that still never, never should be, receive the death penalty. But on top of that, just having zero due process and the whole thing where this woman does have to then lay next to her husband, whose name is now being circulated as a drug pusher, which she will probably never receive any justice for him or for their family. It really is a situation that we can't even fathom.
So is this, I mean, first of all, so much of the focus is on, in the war on drugs, it's always been, well, the focus hasn't been that way. The focus is on supposedly getting the kingpins, the big drug lords. But invariably, it's the low-level people that are rounded up and punished. And is there any evidence that they're going after the drug kingpins in the Philippines? If this is just, you know, a random chaotic invitation for anybody to go out and shoot anybody else?
Right. Well, what we see the world over is that the punitive measures of drugs policy fall most often on the lowest level of the drug chain, whether it's, you know, low-level drug dealers or people who use drugs, and those that really commit the most violent crimes or the heads of organized crime operations are the ones that rarely get face imprisonment or get targeted effectively. And I think this is a continuation of that when you have people on the street taking the law into their own hands. They're targeting other vulnerable people. It is unlikely that the head of a successful organized crime unit would be able to put themselves in such a vulnerable position with security that so often accompanies the head of organized crime units. So yes, I think this is a continuation of global drug policies that really do fall most heavily on the most vulnerable and actually often keep those that most direct the global drug supply chain out of reach of the hands of law enforcement.
But is there any evidence that the Philippines are afflicted with drug abuse more than in any other countries? Or is there a particular epidemic going on in the Philippines to warrant this kind of... It's not just this outrageous behavior and the example set by the president of the country. It's as though this is his number one priority.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, this is what he's using, sort of the call to purge the society from drug use is what the president is using as his excuse for this. And so often we hear, you know, heightened fears and myths around drug epidemics that are then used as excuses for extremely punitive policies. Does the Philippines have problematic drug use above the regional average? I'm not sure. Whatever the case is, if there are people that are using drugs problematically, what they need is help and health and voluntary, humane treatment, not this kind of unlawful killings, which usually just serve for politicians as sort of a way to rouse sometimes popular support for being tough on crime, while knowing that it doesn't serve as a deterrent or effective drug control policy.
So what I find extraordinary is that you would think that the biggest issue facing the Philippines, amongst its biggest issues, is the growing assertiveness of China. And the Philippines just won a big case in the international courts against the Chinese expansion into the South China Sea. And they've actually taken over an island that's about 100 miles from the Philippines, Scarborough Shoals, and mm-hmm. built facilities on that. And the Philippines won this case. And it does impact them in terms of their defense, but mostly in terms of their food supplies, their fish supplies, etc. And yet this same president who's out calling upon his citizens to go out and shoot drug dealers or anybody that's suspected of using, dealing, or, you know, anybody that's even rumored to have anything to do with drugs, and yet he's been incredibly silent on what you'd think would be a number one priority, which is how do you deal with China and how do you take advantage of the fact that the international courts have ruled in your favor?
Yeah, and we've actually heard from, you know, different organizations that he has been a mixed bag on some other things, which is surprising, and that you know, this his call to for these murders did take people by surprise because it hadn't exactly been in line with some of his other actions. But it is incomprehensible to me why he would seize on this particular issue and bring it to the height that it actually is, drug policy, instead of focusing on other sort of not more important issues, but issues that might be more worthy of popular rhetoric and keeping drug issues to the health service and treatment providers.
So just in the last minute or so, Hannah Hetzer, let's return to the question, which is the title of your article at the Huffington Post, Why is the U.S. Silent on Massacre of Drug Users in the Philippines? You mentioned that Secretary of State Kerry recently met with the new president of the Philippines, Duterte, and he's committing $32 million to support law enforcement training and efforts in the Philippines, but made no mention of the unlawful killings, as far as we know. Surely, with this front page picture that's gone viral around the world, do you think there's going to be some, is your organization putting pressure on Kerry?
We really hope to secure a response from Kerry and from the Secretary of State, from the State Department on this issue. We think that the amount of pressure that was put on the United Nations to respond by these organizations, ours included, that signed the letter, and the media, the outcry in the media that followed, resulted in two bodies of the United Nations coming out today after, you know, weeks of being silent and having to respond to this. And we hope that now that we're elevating the role that the U.S. is playing in traveling to the Philippines in holding talks on security cooperation without making mention of the horrific state of affairs there right now, will trigger a response. And we will be doing all we can to put pressure on the administration to come up with a response, and to also tie any funding and assistance from the United States to the Philippines on the condition that human rights are respected and that there is immediate halt to this these killings in the name of drug control.
And just in closing, though, so many of the what's apparently going on is that most of these killings are done by the police, and they're mostly just basically going into these very poor neighborhoods and then turning them into free fire zones. So it sounds to me not just about the drug issue, but just about sort of beating up on the poor, almost a class issue. Is that a dimension to this?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think what we do find in most places we work, drug policy is levied most heavily on the most vulnerable sections of society, be they racial and ethnic minorities, be they working class and low income parts of society, are really the people that bear the brunt of enforcement efforts, and those that have more resources and have more power are the ones that that rarely are face consequences for, you know, drug use or a potential sale. So I am sure that as a continuation of these policies that take place around the world, this is also manifesting itself in ways that really affect those that are most vulnerable.
And of course, the ultimate irony is that the widow of the rickshaw driver, who apparently was a drug addict, who was murdered, and the picture, the iconic picture of her cradling her dead husband in her arms. She voted for Duterte on the elections of last May, the 9th. So I thank you for joining us, Hannah Hetzer.
Thank you very much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Hannah Hetzer, who's a senior policy manager of the Americas at the Drug Policy Alliance, based in New York, where she serves as the liaison for Latin America and broader international issues. She spent 2013 in Uruguay working on the campaign that made it the first country in the world to legalize marijuana. And she has an article at the Huffington Post, "Why is the U.S. silent on massacre of drug users in the Philippines?" We're going to take a brief station break. We're back examining the record-breaking commutations of 214 federal prisoners by President Obama today.
This place is a prison, and these people aren't your friends. There's guards at the on-ramps, armed to the teeth. And you make
nung isilang ka sa mundong ito, laking tuwa ng magulang mo, at ang kamay nilang yung ilaw. At ang nanay at tatay mo'y di malaman ang gagawin.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Donna Hamm, who's a retired judge, who is the founder and executive director of Middle Ground Prison Reform, an all-volunteer nonprofit organization that works to reform Arizona's criminal justice system in terms of executive clemency, such as commutation of sentences and imminent danger of death, parole, revocation, modification of release conditions, and absolute discharge. She is a former lower court judge in Conoco and Maricopa counties, as well as a former town magistrate pro tem. Welcome to Background Briefing, Donna Hamm.
Thank you very much.
And President Obama today commuted 214 sentences, which is more than any. It's actually the single largest grant of commutations in the nation's history, more than any president since Calvin Coolidge. And I guess the first thing to do is to make a distinction, right, between commutation and pardons.
Yes, a commutation of sentence is a reduction in the sentence imposed. It is not a pardon, which absolves a person of the consequences of the crime. So the commutation does not erase the crime or expunge the record. It merely reduces the amount of time that a person must serve on the already imposed sentence.
And presumably, whatever restrictions are on that person would continue, right? There'd be, what, parole and supervised visits, et cetera?
Yes. A governor or a president can issue what's called a time-served commutation, which at that moment that it is signed would end the sentence altogether, including any subsequent supervision. But he can also issue a commutation which includes continued supervision in the community until the actual expiration of the sentence. So by reducing the sentence, it doesn't necessarily end the sentence. It simply reduces it.
And these are all, these commutations, these 214 federal inmates that have been commuted by President Obama on Wednesday, that is obviously, that's the federal system, but is there any difference between state and federal?
Absolutely. The only sentences that the President of the United States has jurisdiction to commute are, in fact, federal sentences. He has no jurisdiction to apply the commutation or executive clemency process to any states. Those fall under the jurisdiction of each individual governor. And, for example, in Arizona, even the governor doesn't have sole
opportunity to grant a commutation unless it's first been recommended to him by the Board of Executive Clemency. So in many cases, the governor is not the only person involved in the executive clemency or commutation process. It first has to be recommended by a board.
So it seems that most of these 214 prisoners whose sentences have been commuted by the president have been convicted of low-level drug offenses. Apparently the longest serving of them is Richard L. Reser of Sedgwick, Kansas, who was given a 40-year sentence for dealing methamphetamine. He's to be released apparently on December the 1st. Let's get into that issue. And I know the president is the only U.S. president, I think, to visit a actual prison, is he not? And I remember him making that extraordinary statement there, but for the grace of God, you know, I could have been in there, you know, for when I was a teenager smoking a marijuana joint, you know. So that seems to be the subtext and something that this president has been trying to work on. But you can only really make substantive changes, surely, Judge Hamm, when the legislature makes these changes. This is a kind of a Band-Aid approach, isn't it?
Well, it really is, and I think you've hit on an important point. It's my understanding that thus far, during the 7.5 years that President Obama has been in office, that he's issued a total of about 562 commutations, which is clearly more than any president has issued during one term or two terms of office since the history of our country and since the commutation process was authorized. But what this really speaks to is that we have an utterly ineffective Congress that has refused to deal with the criminal code, in particular the criminal code as it applies to crack versus cocaine, powder cocaine sentences, which have huge disparities and have racial undertones to the way those sentences were applied. So really, I think the Congress needs to hang its head in shame for the fact that this type of action is left to the executive of our government when they, in fact, should be dealing with the sentencing guidelines and the code for the federal sentencing guidelines.
So is there anything, though, on the horizon that gives you, because you're working in the trenches, Judge Hamm, is there anything on the horizon politically that gives you some hope? Because I recall reading a little while back that the Koch brothers, who've multi-billionaires who put a lot of money into politics, they're libertarians. They have joined with other liberal groups opposing long incarcerations, and particularly for minor drug offenses. Their approach, I suppose, is a libertarian one about, you know, economic inefficiency. And I think a lot of people on the left, on the other side, are pretty opposed to private prisons, which have grown exponentially. So do you see a kind of liberal conservative or liberal libertarian alliance here as a possible way to break this logjam with the dysfunctional Congress?
Well, certainly a liberal conservative alliance would be required, because that is really the only way that anything can ever move effectively through both houses, both the Congress, the House and the Senate, and onto the president's desk. But what we've seen over the last couple of years are proposals made by various groups that seem to be bipartisan. But suddenly, because I'm not sure if it's because they've been waylaid by the electoral process of the president or other issues in Congress, but issues seem to have died on the vine, and now Congress is in recess, and when they go back, I seriously doubt if there's time or the will for them to come together sufficiently to do anything prior to the November election. So once again, we have a Congress that really hasn't done anything. They've talked a good game They seem to be very, very interested in this issue, and then they back off and lose interest in it, or people change their minds and weaken their positions and their resolve. So it really is going to take some concerted effort to get them to really take this issue by the horns and actually deal with it on a legislative level.
So in your work, both on the bench and now as the executive director of the Middle Ground Prison Reform, have you ever been able to figure out what this compulsion to punish is that seems to be deep in the DNA of our society? I was just listening to a piece on NPR, I think it was yesterday or the day before, of somebody who's written a book about this registry of sexual offenders that people get put on. And he told the story of an 11-year-old boy in Texas who was sort of playing with his brother and sister, and they were sort of, you know, doing that sort of prepubescent explorations of each other's bodies. And somehow a teacher had heard about it and reported it. And this 11-year-old boy was sent to prison for a couple of years. And then he was put on this registry, and his life's been ruined. I mean, you know, because you can never get off it. And it has lots of restrictions. I'm not making a case, you know, that there shouldn't be registries or we shouldn't deal with sexual predators. But the idea of sexual predators is to keep children safe from sexual predators. And in this case, the child has been ruined. His life's
been... Well, I think what we're seeing is, I read a terrific book many, many years ago called The Rich Get Richer and the Poor Get Prison by Jeffrey Ryman. It was used primarily as a textbook in sociology classes in universities. And he posits in that book that our society, we claim to be a classless society. There's no formal caste system here, but we have a base need to look down on other people. And looking down on prisoners, people who've been convicted of felonies, is a very easily targeted group to continue to punish. And there does seem to be in our society a very concerted effort to keep the mark of Cain on people even after they've fully expired their sentence, with unable to get housing or unable to get employment or unable to be licensed for certain jobs, even long after they have completed their sentence, even long after their civil rights have been restored. And so we do have this base need to keep a certain group of people below us. And I think it's a fundament of our moral fiber that we look this way at other people. And then when you have the proliferation of private prisons as we do today, who are actually given contracts, as they are in Arizona, to keep their beds full, or they will be paid at a 90 or 100% occupancy rate, even if the beds are not full, that incentivizes our legislature to keep those people flowing through the prison system, because they're going to have to pay for those contracted beds anyway. And so it becomes a very politicized event. And, of course, criminal justice should not be. It should be the least politicized government operation that we engage in. And yet it's become very politicized.
Well, I believe in Arizona, former Governor Jan Brewer's, some of her top members of her staff were involved in some kind of revolving door with these private prisons. I remember interviewing somebody from the Arizona Republic on that. Is that your recollection?
Well, my understanding is she had some folks in her administration who ultimately left her administration and went to work for the private prison lobbying industry. which it technically is not an illegal thing to do. But certainly, you have to look at the record of the private prison industry to see what actual monetary contributions they have made to various politicians' campaigns, and that probably is more indicative of what influence they have gained. But our problems with over-incarceration started long, long before the private prison industry came into being or became powerful. And so this base need to look down at other people, and then, of course, the drug war, which started, and we have to blame both Republicans and Democrats for this, because not only did the Reagan administration begin the drug war and so forth, but Bill Clinton's administration ratcheted up the incarceration of persons for 85% of their time, and that was tied to money that was given to the states by the federal government if they would ramp up their criminal justice code. And so there's no one party that is blameless in this particular situation that we have now, with an incarceration rate that is extraordinary for an allegedly free country.
And just to close on being a free country, are we the only democracy where prisoners lose their right to vote?
I don't know that we're the only country, but we are certainly the only country that removes that right in some cases permanently, and also makes it very difficult to retrieve that right. Some of the obstacles to regaining the right to vote are insurmountable, because a person not only has to complete their prison sentence, but they have to pay off restitution or fines, which are completely or should be completely unrelated to their ability to participate in our democracy. So that's yet another mark of Cain that we make someone with a felony conviction carry sometimes for the remainder of their lives.
Well, Donna Hamm, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Donna Hamm, who's a retired judge who's the founder and executive director of Middle Ground Prison Reform, an all-volunteer nonprofit organization that works to reform Arizona's criminal justice system in terms of executive clemency, such as commutation of sentences and imminent danger of death, parole revocation, modification of release conditions, and absolute discharge. She is a former lower court judge in Conoco and Maricopa counties, as well as a former town magistrate pro tem. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared.